So, one little piece of news is that I was really planning to blow off this semester and not do anything new or exciting for you guys, but I haven't been able to help myself. So there's all these really cool stuff that's going to be coming up in the next class or two, new demos and really fun stuff to interact with. So, I can't wait to get to those. But let's see what the plan is for right now. So, first, any comments or questions? Anybody need to tell me anything before I get started? Okay then, good. Like no one had any trouble. Did anyone try to log into the Sakai site? Did anyone run into any trouble logging into the Sakai site? Wow. Good, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. So, I guess that's actually on my list. Show Sakai. So if you haven't seen it yet, it looks like a pretty good percentage of people have tried it, and those who tried it seem to be successful. So if you haven't tried it yet, please go and check it out. If you do try it and you have questions, let me know, and then I can do some kind of a demo in class just so you can see what it is that everybody's looking at. Is Monica here? I won't introduce her then. So last time I had Ari stand up, he's one of the two TAs assigned to the class. He had the cool Alan Turing shirt on. But Monica Babish is also a TA, and I didn't even mention her, which just seems so wrong. But she's a very nice lady. In fact, she's been with me since I started doing this class 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago. So she's going to be mostly in charge of grading homeworks, and both of them are going to be available for office hours and things like that. So, and they both seem very, very friendly, very nice. Ari's new. Ari just started grad school here this semester. But all right. But he seems like a very nice guy, very smart, and he put together the coolest demo that I'll show you probably on Wednesday. We'll get to that. So all right. So what else? So I did get one question about the iClickers. I'm hoping more people have iClickers this time. We're going to do a couple questions on the iClickers. People asked about registering them. What we're going to do is in the very first homework assignment, there's going to be a question which is, what is your iClicker number? If you look on the back of your iClicker, there's a number. It turns out to be... Yeah, so the ones, presumably the white ones that you have, it's easier to see. There's a little sequence of digits at the bottom. Some of those digits are A, B, C, D, and E, and F. This is actually a number in hexadecimal, which is a shortened way of writing out things in binary. So maybe at some point, if you really care, we can go through what it is that these actually mean. But the important thing is it's just an identifier for your clicker. So if I know who's got which clicker, then I can give you credit for having answered the questions that you answered. So make sure to answer that correctly on the first homework assignment so we can match you up. And that's how we'll do the registration process. There's no special website to go to or anything like that. You just need to type in the characters and I'll match it up from there. Okay? Any other? Oh yes, a question.
What if we already went to the iClicker website and registered?
I don't know that I can. No, you'll still need to answer it on the homework because I don't know how to get that information. So you're registered with someone. It's just not me. So I can't do anything with that. Unless you could send me mail telling me about that website, and it's possible I can get some of the registrations from there. Save you the trouble. But at the moment, I don't even know where you type that.
iClicker.com.
What is it? iClicker.com?
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe I'll make myself a note. Now, presumably I'll forget that I wrote that there, and then I'll have to ask you to get it. But anyway, there we go. All right. So I think we're good to go. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to ask a couple questions, clicker questions, so you can, you've got the clickers now, to practice the clickers, and also to kind of reinforce some of the material that we covered in the first day. So, first question. So, I really ask some services, right? Because if you don't have a clicker, you have nothing to click on to say no. So, presumably, everyone will say yes, except for smart alecs. And then, basically, this is how I can tell whether or not you're smart alec, and I can ignore all the rest of your answers. No, I'm just kidding. We don't need to do this one. I didn't show you this last time. So, I introduced Monica and Ari to some extent, but then there's me. I'm a computer scientist. I got my PhD in 96. I was a professor at Duke for a couple years, and I learned a little bit about basketball while I was there. I didn't know that was why I was going. I came back to New Jersey in 2000 and worked for AT&T Labs for a few years until they said, enough of you, and they sent me out on the street. My whole group, everybody, they just kicked us all out. It was very, very unpleasant. But now I've got really great professor colleagues all over the country because they just went out and got good jobs. Since 2002, I've been here at Rutgers. My lab is called the Rutgers Laboratory for Real Life Reinforcement Learning, or RL to the third power. And there's a picture of me with a dog, a fake robot dog. Well, it's a real robot dog, actually. It's a fake dog. All right. So here's a question that I get asked by other people in my department. So let me get the clicker thing started so you can click in when you're ready. All right. So it says, if you weren't taking this class, what would you have taken in computer science? And so one possibility is CS110, CS111, which is the intro to programming, CS405, the seminar on computer society, or you wouldn't even really be taking computer science except this really fit your schedule very nicely, or whatever. But none is a catch-all. Wait, we have more clickers this time. All right, anybody else need to go? Shut off at 3, 2, 1. All right, stopping. So sort of uniformish, couple E's, and an E, which is interesting. That also will count as smart aleck factor. All right. So now here's the first of the. First of the actual content book questions. So, I have a book at home. I wrote down the barcode of that book, at least in terms of the sequence of digits, except I didn't write down the check digit. So you need to reconstruct what the check digit is based on the other digits. And I'll remind you very briefly how the check digit thing works. But the important thing is, in terms of clicking, if you've actually worked this out already, since there's 10 different digits and only 5 different choices, you can, if you get 3 or 8 as the answer, you click D. You can even click it twice, but it won't make any difference. All right, so I need an eraser. And jump. So just to remind you how the barcode thing works. This is how I remember it. Actually, I don't remember. Does anybody remember how the barcode thing works? You have to take the, let A be the sum of the digits in the even places, no, say the odd places. So the first position, third position, fifth position. And B be the sum of the digits in the even places. And so I'd like to write this in the simplest possible way, but I'd also like it to be correct. So I think what I'm going to do is actually flip back to the lecture. Unless somebody remembers it, and fill me in. Alright, so there's the equation at the top. So 3 times the sum of the odd digits plus the sum of the even digits, we write, is equivalent to 0 mod 10. Which means that 3 times the sum of the odd digits plus the even digits is going to be some multiple of 10. It's going to end in 0 in decimal. All right. So try that out and click in, and then I'll work it out and we'll see if it actually makes any sense. done the other thing. I'm just being distracted. I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure that's describing. Let's see what this is saying here. So, presumably we can figure out what A and B are just by looking at the digits of the number. So, I wrote down the barcode, and I wrote the odds on one line and the evens in the other, because that was easy for me, just 0767140099, and then the one we don't know, which I'm calling X, sort of like an algebra. The sum of the odd digits, I can just add those up, and I get 19. The sum of the even digits, I can add them up, but there's an X, I get 27 plus X. If you got something different, let me know, because arithmetic is never my strong suit. This is why I do computers, because they do the arithmetic for me. Are you with me so far? All right. Then what the equation says is 3 times A plus B equals 0 mod 10. So we need to know what 3 times A plus B is. So 3 times A, 3 times 19, I got 57. I added the evens to that, which was 27 plus X, so I got 84 plus X. And now what it's saying is that that sum has to be 0 mod 10. In other words, it has to be something that adds up to something that has a 0 in the last place, if it doesn't. Right? So what would X have to be in that case? 6, right? 6 is the only thing that fits in here that would get us up to, in this case, 90, which is a multiple of 10. We can't hit any other multiples of 10 with any other value of X between 0 and 9. Right? This could also be 16, but you can't really fit a 16 into the one little space there. So it's a 6. So is that what we have the majority of people saying that? Slightly more people said that than any of the other answers, assuming they didn't mean 1, which would have been the same thing to click on. So does that seem right? Is it the people who got that as the answer, that all go through and make sense? Did anybody get some other answer and you can't figure out why your answer is wrong? So I'm not sure that this is the right answer, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to actually Google that UPC code. And for what it's worth, now I'm embarrassed. Right? Why did I have access to But it fits. Sort of fit. There's an extra 5 digits at the end. Let's try another one. Barcode book. What is it? This is a notebook. This is correct. So you should be able to follow the same procedure. I'm hoping it'll make a little bit more sense this time. We'll have a little more agreement on which choice is correct.
Short-term memory, which I don't, we'll remember that that was 7.
All right, so if you had a question like this where one of the odd digits was missing, you can still figure it out, right? So first we're going to sum up the odd digits. We get 3, 4, 5 plus x. Then we sum up the even digits, and we get 16, 18, 21, 28, 34. We triple the odd digits. What's 3 times this? 15 plus x?
3x.
Ah, yes. 15 plus 3x. 15 plus 3x plus 34, which is equal to 49 plus 3x. Now, we want to fill in a value for x here so that this sum ends up being a multiple of 10. Right? If this were just x would be, sorry, if the 3 wasn't here, we could make x 1, and that would make it add up to 50, and we'd be done. But it's not. It's 3 times x. So what do? We can try 2. That's 3 times 2 is 6. 3, 9, 4, 12, 5, 15, 6, 18, 7, 21. 21, if we let x be 7, then this is 21. 21 plus 49 is 70, which is a multiple of 10. Now, part of this is made easier by the fact that it's 49 is irrelevant. We're only going to worry about the last digit. So really, this is just a 9. We want to know what, when you multiply by 3, gives you something that ends in 1, which is, of course, 7. Oh! That was what we had. Ha-ha, it worked. All right. Any questions on that? We're gonna move out of barcodes now. Not forever. They'll be on the homework in the test and stuff, but we're done talking about it for now. Yes? Good? Monica's here. Say hi, Monica. We talked about you while you weren't here. We said you're a lovely person. Nobody disagreed. Because they don't actually know anything. Alright, let's just do this one. Yeah. Sure. Why not? So let's do it fast. Figuring out stuff and solving problems, and it's like computer science. All right, so it could be that. Euclid's algorithm. So Euclid was a Greek dude. Greek what? Mathematician. A Greek mathematician who worked on number theory, worked on how things like these moduluses worked, and what kind of patterns you can get, and how numbers related to one another. And he actually wrote down a method for figuring out the greatest common divisor of two numbers. This method turns out to be remarkably efficient, and it's essentially what we use in computers now. When a computer needs to calculate the greatest common divisor of two numbers, they run Euclid's algorithm, and there it is in Greek on a stone, let's say. This is the Mayan calendar, which was actually a remarkable feat of engineering and astronomy and computation. You could actually use this as a mirror if you have a face that looks like this. I don't know. Maybe not. But apparently, you can use this to actually figure out where the planets and things are going to be in various times of the year, and it's really amazing. All right. This is Charles Babbage's gravestone in England. Charles Babbage, before there was circuitry, he invented a computer that he made entirely out of metal, like rods and sticks and bars and things, and actually worked out what it would take to make a programmable mechanical computer, which was pretty cool. And in fact, so a lot of people give him credit as kind of the forefather of computer science. And there, you know, it's a pattern on a stone. This is a petroglyph. This is on a cave stone. This is a Chinese abacus, where you can imagine that the little discs are made out of stone. But none of these, in fact, are the pattern on the stone that Phyllis is referring to. Though I think when he named it, he wanted to evoke these kinds of images in our heads, sort of ancient rock formations. But in fact, he's talking about this. He's talking about computer chips. Now, they're very complicated patterns, and it's a little hard to see at this level of magnification, but if you zoom in, there's very intricate, very finely constructed patterns of wires connecting tiny little components to one another, all made out of silicon, basically sand. And this is what computer circuits are made out of. And one of the reasons that computers are actually everywhere and fast and useful and so forth is because people over time have figured out ways of engraving these patterns into the stone, into the silicon, in tiny little bits of silicon wafers that actually are the architecture of a computer, that are actually doing all the computational work. And all our devices are just filled with it. They're all over the place. Xbox has had them too. And they all end up being sort of vaguely similar. One of the cool things about computer game processors is that they tend to have a tremendous amount of processing power and also memory storage. So they actually end up being very powerful computers, but they have dedicated circuitry specifically for moving colors and shapes and patterns around. Two of the students in my lab have started to try to figure out how can we take something like a processor that's used for the Xbox and actually use it to do other kinds of computations fast, not just graphics. It's a very powerful computer. Maybe it's more powerful than the computers that we had access to. But usually they can do a lot more at once. So what Hillis says in the introduction, which I think is worth pointing out, though it's not anything I'm going to test you on, but it kind of gives you a sense of what it is that makes this so cool and why Hillis, for example, is so excited about it. A computer chip has billions of parts, billions of individual little pieces that are all working together. But they're not billions of completely independent parts. They actually follow very regular patterns. And in fact, the way that you construct something with billions and billions of independent pieces is by making sure that they group into patterns and that you can kind of deal with them as groups. So these repeated patterns actually form a kind of a hierarchy, or you can also think of it as being an example of reduction, this fundamental computer science idea where you say, all right, I'm going to put a bunch of these little circuit elements together to create a particular functionality, something that we really need on the chip. And in fact, we may need it multiple times. We make copies of it on the chip. And so this same pattern of circuit elements come together over and over and over again because they do basically the same job. And so that, the way the computers are designed, make that simple. And in fact, I think the subtitle of the book, so the pattern on the stone, the simple ideas that make computers work. And the simple idea is this idea of reduction, that we're going to take very simple pieces and combine them together to make more complicated pieces that we can then treat as simple pieces, because they do what they're supposed to do. You can kind of count on them and think of them as being now very simple. The ideas that make computers go transcend technology. This is not about silicon and circuitry. This is about reduction. This is about putting ideas together and making things that actually perform a task. So Hillis said, you know, computer is actually a terrible name for the device. We should actually call them imagination machines. which I don't think will catch on. But it is very evocative, very poetic kind of way of thinking about what a computer does. In fact, Telus himself was an Imagineer for some years. Does anybody know what an Imagineer is? Yeah. Yeah, so he actually, when he finished the company, I actually worked for him for a little while. When that company imploded, he went to Disney and actually worked at Disney for a while, just coming up with really bizarre inventions of various sorts that got incorporated into various rides. And then he stopped doing that, and now he has some kind of a company out on the West Coast that just does inventions. I think mainly for the Defense Department, so they're like walking dinosaur creatures with laser guns. I don't know, something like that. But he just sits around and thinks of weird stuff all day long. It's not a bad job. All right, so that kind of gets you through the preface. If you have questions about that, you can let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to now dive into chapter one, get started on that. Any questions about the preface? Usually there's not a lot in the preface to talk about. Okay. All right, so chapter one, and I put the talk slides for this for half of this on the web. I got excited in the middle and started making demos and then didn't actually finish changing over all the talk slides. But I will get that out shortly. But I don't think I'll get through all this one day anyway. So this is chapter one. So here's how I think about what's going on in chapter one. So different academic disciplines have different things that they start with. And then an academic discipline tries to make things simpler and simpler over time, to really understand, to get at the root of what their discipline is really about. And different disciplines have ended up converging on very different things as kind of where things start for them. So chemistry, for example, everything's made out of molecules. And they can go all the way down to the level of the molecule, and then they can talk about how, or actually you probably want to go almost down to atoms, right? You build molecules out of atoms, you take molecules and put them together in various ways, and you get different kinds of chemical reactions. But at the bottom, we're talking about molecules. Physics, now lately, people talk about string theory, this idea that there's some patterns of strings right there, seven different patterns of strings. That you can talk about everything that exists in our physical universe as actually being constructed of little vibrating bits of string. And I can never tell if they mean this as a metaphor or if they really think that there's little vibrating bits of string. I don't know. But the thing is that now, once they've taken everything that they know about and reduced it to this notion of a string, then all of physics is now grounded in these strings. And so it really, in some sense, anything you want to know in physics, you can always go back to the level of the string and then go forward from there and figure out how all the other pieces come about. In mathematics, for a while, there wasn't really something like this. But over time, and now, you know, mathematics is older, I think, than a lot of these other disciplines. So back maybe the 1700s, they started saying, you know what, we can take all the different mathematical things that we talk about and reduce it to this notion of sets, set theory, collections of items. And everything that we care about can all be constructed out of these sets. And so there's a group of mathematicians that set about showing how that was the case. And that gave a firm foundation to everything that they did in mathematics. So we can keep doing this about other disciplines if we wanted to, but I'm going to now switch over and say, what about computer science? Computer science, at the very bottom, at the base level, it's about bits. And really, it's hard to imagine anything simpler. So a bit is, one way to think about it, is the smallest unit of information. It's true versus false, or one versus zero, on versus off, white versus black. I mean, just a distinction, and you're going to make one category and the other category, and those are going to be two different things. So I don't know if people have seen this symbol. Anybody recognize this? What is that? So is it an on button or an off button?
Both.
It's the both. That's right. Right. And in particular, look what it is.
It's a one and a zero.
It's on and off together. Right? Isn't that cool? It's like, this is it. You're done now. Now you know what you need to know about bits. It's right on the back of your computer. You could just poke it all day long. All right. So that's bits. And in fact, the word bit itself is a portmanteau word. This is a word that's actually constructed by taking two other words and glomming together. And I needed to think of an example. So, like, you know, craptacular, I think, is a really great example. If you're familiar with this word, it's like something that's so spectacularly crappy. Stick those two words together and you get craptacular. Crumbelievable is one that I heard relatively recently. Can anybody think of any other good portmanteau words? Everybody's favorites? There's some that are actually now considered valid words in English. I don't think crepacular is yet, but soon. I'm pretty sure soon. Anything? You got one?
Chillax.
Chill and relax. I never heard that. Did you just make it up, or did people say that? Chill and relax. It's a real word. Thank you for educating me. I appreciate that. All right, chillax. And you, this is a command that you give to someone, right? It's like, you just chillax, like that? Apparently, I did not deliver that properly. What do you got?
Broody-licious.
Booty-licious, sure, sure. Booty on one side and delicious on the other. I was thinking of things like spork. People know the word spork. It's like a spoon and a fork. All right, anyway, we can sit around and talk about it. Apparently, I probably should cut this off before we cross some line that I'm probably not allowed to cross. But the word bit, even though it's a tiny little word, it actually is constructed out of two other words. It's short for binary digit. So binary is the base 2 number system. We usually work in decimal, base 10, but binary is base 2. And in base 2, there's zeros and ones, and that's all there are. In base 10, there's 0 through 9. In base 5, there's 0 through 4. In base 16, there's 0 through, it turns out to be F. You can think of it as 15. And so apparently, a digit meaning, single digit, used by, so Claude Shannon started using this word. And that was and he said that John Tukey came up with it. He's a statistician. Famous statistician, came up with lots of, like the Tukey plot, it turns out, which you probably never heard of, but it's fun to say. So feel free, this is a homework assignment. Go, when you see someone on the street, just say, hey, Tukey plot. All right. So decimal is 0 through 9, binary is just 0 and 1. And so there's this nice relationship between a bit that we're going to talk about in the computer and a number system consisting of just those two. So why bits? Why do we care so much about bits? Why not, let's say, trips, just to make up a word? Like 0, 1, and 2. That would be nice. You know, you can get like a peace sign thing going. It could be very lovely. So why bits? So there's two reasons that make this really a great idea. One is it's simple. You really can't do anything simpler than dividing the zeros from the ones. You can have just zeros, but then it's hard to really get anywhere. It's just zeros. So you need something other than zeros, and you got the ones, and then you can be done at that point. But interestingly, it's powerful. Sequences of bits can represent seemingly everything. So seemingly anything. Anything that people represent in computers now, which is pretty much everything in the world around us, are represented as strings of bits. Not just a single zero and a one, but patterns of zeros and ones. And these patterns can represent very complicated objects. So just to get philosophical for a moment, there's lots of places in history where people make this 0-1 kind of distinction and do very artistic things with it. So, like, this is an Escher engraving. Escher did all his stuff in black and white. But look what he did with it. I don't know if you can tell what's going on there, but there's fish at the bottom and birds at the top. But actually, the fish are in the white space between the birds, and the birds are in the black space between the fish, and they just kind of merge. He was a crazy guy. Yeah, sure. The Bible talks about the light, the darkness, the ones, the zeros. The Eastern religions have yin and yang. It's all just bits, right? It's making that fundamental distinction between this and that, yin and yang. But we now, maybe more mundanely, represent lots of other things using bits. So the two that are really useful and come up an awful lot are sound and images. So sound, how do you represent sound as bits? Well, it turns out, it's a little bit hard to see here, but it turns out that sound is a waveform. It's how much power there is moving through the air as a function of time. So this is time moving forward, and the wiggle gives you a sense of what the waveform is, what the sound form is. How do you turn this into bits? Well, the first thing you have to do is actually discretize it. So time, now, instead of being this continuous quantity, becomes a series of very closely spaced ticks. And at each tick, there's some level, some strength level. And instead of it being some continuous number, could be any number, we're going to discretize that too. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And so now a pattern like this turns into this little stairway, step stool kind of pattern. But if you put the intervals close enough together and you have there be enough variation in the steps, you can very closely approximate any continuous curve that you want. Once it's discretized like this, then what you do is you have just a sequence of a binary value. So just say, how much strength is at this moment, at this moment, at this moment, at this moment, and it just becomes a long sequence of bits like that. Images are the same way. You think of them as being a continuous quantity. There's you know, x, y, and the color, and the brightness, and there's all these different values. But in fact, you can just take it and just chop it up, right? A lot of this representing things in terms of bits is like you just chop the bejeebers out of things until you have small enough pieces. So in this case, here we've got a nice picture of someone playing some sport. We'll call it football. And if you actually zoom in on it, you can see that it's actually made out of these blocks, these solid blocks of color, which are called pixels. Each pixel is from usually up to 256 to the third, different possible color values. How much red is in this rectangle? How much blue? How much green? And that the levels are between 0 and 255. And so we can represent all those quantities in terms of sequences of bits, and we'll talk about how the binary number system works at a later time. But the thing is that once you've chopped it down fine enough where it's just, you can just say, oh, it's a number. This is how much white is at this one discrete position in the image, and then you just string all those together, just zeros and ones, and you get this, you know, lovely, triumphant looking. Okay. So what makes this really work is that you may need lots and lots of bits to represent something that you care about. Right, because if you just cared about 0 and 1, then you just need one bit. But if you care about pictures and sounds and so forth, you're going to need a whole lot more bits. So let me give you a concrete example. So iPod, or pick your favorite MP3 player. I don't mean this to be an ad. If you've got, say you buy an iPod and it's a 60-gigabyte iPod. Well, what does that mean? What this means is it's got 60 gigabytes. All right, we're going to break it. This is reduction, right? We're going to break it down now. What's a gigabyte? So 1 gigabyte is 1 billion bits. So, thank you. 1 billion bytes, gigabyte. A gigabit would be a billion bits. Gigabyte is a billion bytes. What's a byte? Well, byte is 8 bits. It's a funny word that just means 8 bits. So what are we talking about here? The 60-gigabyte iPod has storage places for 8 times 60 times a billion bits. And that's all they mean. And you, in fact, when iPods first came out and all the computer geeks wanted one, but they couldn't figure out how to get their grants to pay for them, they realized, my advisor anyway told me that she did this, she went out and bought one, and it basically uses it as a hard drive. It's just a storage device for bits. Now, she can store all her work on it. She can store her lecture slides. She can store her papers, anything that she needs, all the data from her experiments, can all just be stored there because it's just a storage device for bits. What's nice about the way that the Apple people set this up is that these bits can very easily be converted into images and sound, which is probably a lot more fun to people than, say, my advisor's data. So, all right, so let's talk about how this works. So now you've got a 60 times a billion times 8 bits, places to put all these things. The sound format that's used on the iPod is, it does 128 kbps. That's kilobits per second, kilo meaning 1,000. So 128,000 bits are used to represent 1 second of sound. 1 second, it's like, you know, thousands of bits, 128,000 bits. But that's just 1 second of sound. If you want to represent a whole song, you need a whole bunch of seconds strung together. I see what you're asking. So if you just saw that abbreviation, capital G, lowercase b, you might think gigabit, you might think gigabyte. Is there some typographical way that people consistently distinguish between them?
You define kbps as kilobits. Quite as uppercase,
I often, but I can't say that it's 100%. I don't think you can really depend on that. But yes, that would, I think people who are being more careful, we'll use that consistently. I actually just cut and pasted these off of websites, so whoever I stole that from, let's say, is not completely consistent about it. But yeah, that would be nice. If you use capital B for byte and lowercase b for bit, that would be an easy way to tell them apart. I just don't think you can depend on it. Right, so 62,500 minutes of sound, or 15, well, okay, so let's see how this works. So if each song was about 4 minutes, and you had 15,000 of them, that would be 62,500 minutes. Each minute is 60 seconds. Each second takes 128,000 bits. to store. And so when you multiply all that out, that's 60 gigabytes. So what's really what's going on? So when they say this device stores 15,000 songs, it's not that there's 15,000 places for songs. There's actually 60 times 8 times a billion spaces for bits. And, you know, roughly it takes some number of bits to store each song. But if you have really long songs, you're not going to be able to get 15,000 of them on it. So that's kind of interesting. All right, but iPods can also store video. So what about video? The screen is 320 by 240 pixels. Each of those pixels is made up of 3 bytes. 1 byte saying how much red is in that pixel, 1 for green, and 1 for blue. So the screen itself, you need that's 76,800 pixels, which if you wanted to write down all the bits that it would take to specify all of their colors, just one moment in time, that's 1.8 million bits to write down the screen of the iPod. So this is why you need multiple billions of these to actually store anything interesting. So at 30 frames per second, so that's sort of TV quality, maybe not better than TV quality, 30 frames per second, that's 55.3 million bits per second, or 144 minutes of video sans sound, you could store on a 60 gigabyte device like that. So once you have places for things and you have ways of storing information as bits, then you can just chop it up and use it however is appropriate. And that's really all that's going on these types of devices. Okay, cool, anyway. You could object to this point and say, actually, you can get more pictures and more sound in there. And then there's this thing called compression. There's ways of actually storing more or less the same picture, but with a lot fewer bits than writing down the color for each individual pixel. And we'll talk about that later in the semester. So rest assured that you can probably get more than 144 minutes of video. All right, so what I'd like to do is now work up to what kind of mathematics can we do with these bits? How do we actually work with these bits? And what I found over the years is that it's hard to just jump straight into that. It's easier if I first prime your mind a little bit and remind you how algebra looks. Now, I know that you know this, and that's okay, but I want it to be really fresh because when we move over to bits and Boolean algebra, it should just be, that should become very obvious because it looks just like this. All right, so when you're doing regular algebra, the kind of algebra that you do in high school, variables stand for numbers, right? So you can have a variable like x that can store a number like 3. You have a variable like p, which maybe is 22 sevenths, like pi, almost. A could be another variable that's minus 2. But there's all these different numbers, and you can put them into these storage places. All right. Then there's operations that you can do on numbers or on variables that represent numbers. There's two kinds of operators that I want to talk about. Binary operators, different meaning of binary, don't get confused. And unary operators. Binary operators here just means operators that act on two numbers at one time. They take two numbers in and they produce one number out. So what's an example of a binary operator? Yeah, so what's the operator? What's the thing that takes two numbers and then turns it into one number? Plus, addition, right. Addition is a binary operator. Now, sometimes it's used in other ways, but at its root, it's a binary operator. It takes two numbers and then smooshes them together and you get a new number out, which is, as it turns out, the sum. But that's not what's important right now. What else is a binary operator? Multiplication, right? You can take two numbers. It takes two numbers in and then turns them into one number out. The product. Anything else? There's some that are not up there. Sure, division, right. Division, you take two numbers in, you produce one number out. Unless the second number was a zero, in which case you put two numbers in and then all hell breaks loose. So you want to be careful about that. Anything else? There's this one. Exponentiation is also a binary operator, right? You have the base, unlike the other, well actually, like division, it's not symmetric, right? It matters which one is in which position. Not commutative, that's a better word. All right, so those are all binary operations on regular numbers, okay? This is not super rocket science, right? This is all okay so far. We also have unary operators, things that take one number in and change it and take one number out. So, okay, I'll give you one example, negation, right? Negation is an operator that you give it a number like 11 and it turns it into negative 11, Or you put in a number like -2, and you get out 2, right? It takes number, a single number in and spits out a possibly different number. When does it spit out a different number? When does it spit out the same number?
Zero.
When is a door not a door? When it's zero. No, never mind. All right, so any other examples of unary operators? Absolute value is excellent. Yes, absolute value is it takes in one number and then returns it on the positive side, right? If it takes in a positive number, it returns that same number out. If it takes in a negative number, it negates that and returns that. Good. Absolute value is a great example. Square root is another, which I had forgotten I put on the slide, so I was thinking that you would say that. All right, so we'll call with this. Binary operators, variables, unary operators, it's all easy stuff. All right, now we're going to switch over and we're going to talk about Boolean algebra. The Boolean algebra is just like algebra. Sort of, except we don't have numbers anymore. What we've got are bits. And in this case, it's true and false are the two values that we can work with. So we can still have variables. We can have variables that stand for bits, like x is true, p is false. But those are the only two values that exist in this whole algebra. So there is nothing else other than true and false. But we can talk about operations on these values, these truth values. So the classic ones, there's others, but the classic ones, and we'll spend most of our time talking about them, are things that take two bits in and one bit out. One of them is called AND, or a conjunction. One is called OR disjunction. And they kind of work like their words, what the words mean in English, but I'll give you concrete examples of them in just a bit. All right. And there's also a really important unary operator, which is NOT. Which is kind of like negation, but not really. Where you say not of false, you take false and you not it and it turns into true. If you take true and you not it, it turns into false. So it flips the truth value from whatever it is to the other thing that it is. Sorry, the other thing that it's not. Okay, all right, so is that okay so far? I mean, I start to use these ideas, but I wanted to make them as unscary at first as I could. All right, so I want to talk about the Boolean operators AND and OR and how you should kind of think about them. How we use them in logic, but also more or less in real life. So this is my attempt to try to get these across. So let's start off with, let's say we want to express in Boolean algebra, when is it okay to be in an R-rated movie? So according to the little symbol that I downloaded off the web, it says, restricted, under 17 requires accompanying parent or adult guardian. So you are 17 or older, so this is really an or kind of situation. You're 17 or older, or you have an adult guardian with you. Then it's okay. All right, so we'll say this in terms of Boolean algebra. So let's say x is a Boolean variable. It stands for either true or false, but what it means at the moment is a person that we're talking about is 17 or older. And we have another Boolean variable, y, and that represents whether that person's accompanied by an adult guardian. So each of these could be true or false. And then the rule, the R-rated rule, says a person can see an R-rated movie if, and only if, x or y. If either x is true or y is true. So just to be concrete, here's some examples. So we've got this guy, Bill. He's 22. He's seeing the movie with his stepdad. So is he 17 or older? Yes. So X is true. Is he with a parent or guardian? Yes. He's with a stepdad. So that's true. And so X or X is true. All right. So X or X is an expression like A minus B or whatever. It's X or X that has either value true or false. And in particular, it's true if both X and Y are both true, then X or Y is true. All right, here's another one. Samantha's 17. She's seeing the movie alone. So she's 17 or older. That's true. She's not with a parent or guardian, so Y is false. So X or Y, in this case, is true. Right? Only one of them needs to be true for X or Y to be true. And she's allowed to see the movie according to the rule. This is why OR is the right operator for this case. All right, Seth is 16, and is there with both of his parents. So X is false. He's not 17 or older. Y is true. He is with a parent or guardian. And X or Y is true. So he's allowed to see the movie. And the last case, Jessica's 13, and she's there with friends from school. So X, is she 17 or older? That's false. Y, is she with a parent or guardian? That's false. And the expression x or y, when both x and y are false, is false. Okay? You with me? So or takes two truth values in. They could both be true. One is true, the other is false. They could both be false. But once it combines them together, you get an answer, true or false. And the way that the OR operator works, the way that it's defined, is the output is true if either of the inputs are true or both of them are true, but it's false if both of the inputs are false. That's how OR works. I feel it. So here's the thing. I would like a question, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to elicit one. So I'm getting the look like everybody is thinking this is sort of dumb and obvious. But then later, when I ask you to do this, you're going to just, not everybody, but a big group of you is just going to lock up entirely, like you have absolutely no idea what I'm asking. And I'm trying to figure out how to bridge that gap between making it sound really obvious and making you actually be able to do it. So is there any part of this that seems unclear? Anything that I could clarify better at this point? It just seems so obvious now. Yeah, I'm just going to press on, and then later when you have trouble, just tell me, and then I'll know, and maybe I'll be able to fix it. All right. So here's another kind of rule. It turns out that this is an AND type rule. I found this on the Rutgers website. All vehicles parked on university property must be registered and display a valid Rutgers permit. Now, AND has a very special meaning in terms of Boolean logic, Boolean algebra. So for example, if X stands for whether or not the car is registered, and Y stands for whether or not it displays a valid permit, it's only allowed to park at Rutgers if X and Y, and if both have to be true. So we could go through this kind of extended example once again, which I won't, but we'll get, I'll do two of the cases. So you know, Bill's car is registered and displays a valid permit. So X is true, it's registered. B is true, it's displaying a valid permit. X and Y is true, and he's allowed to park the car. On the other hand, Jessica's visiting with no registration or permit. She doesn't have, it's not registered, doesn't have a permit. X and Y is false, and she's not allowed to park there. But the other two cases are when one is true and the other one is false. And with AND, you lose. They have to both be true for the AND to be true. It's different than OR. OR was just one or the other, had to be true. Or both is okay. All right. And then NOT is sort of obvious. Found this rule as well. It's not allowed by federal law to provide tobacco products to a person under 18 years of age. If X is a person is under 18, then the rule is not X. All right. So they're biased. All right. So here's a slightly more formal version of this definition. These are the most important Boolean algebra operation. X and Y is true if both X and Y are true. X or Y is true only if either X or Y is true, or both. And not X is true only if X is false. So it's a lot like their English meanings, but they're unambiguous. So sometimes people use OR, especially OR. I have tons of examples of people using OR, and they don't really mean this kind of OR. So like, waiters in a restaurant and says, would you like to order chicken or beef? It's like a wedding or bar mitzvah or something. And so the meaning of OR, it should be that it's okay. I've correctly answered his question as long as I choose chicken or beef or both. That's what OR means in the logical sense. What does he really mean? He wants me to choose chicken. You said OR again. Chicken. So what are the legal cases? Let's
chicken
older
beef.
Chicken as opposed to beef. That's good. So let's write down the four cases. So chicken, beef, and whether or not the waiter's okay with me. Right, because I actually have scored pretty high on the whole smart aleck scale. So I have a tendency to answer, it's like, well, according to Boolean algebra, waiters don't like that. In case you were wondering. All right, so here's the four cases. I order neither chicken nor beef. I order just beef. I order just chicken. Or I order both. Okay, these are the four different possibilities. When is the waiter not going to think that I'm a smart aleck? Is this okay? If he says chicken or beef, can I say neither?
No.
This is debatable. So I'll ask, what do you think we should go with? And they don't give me a real hard time. So let's say, we'll say true for that. It's okay to order an item. Is it okay to just get the beef?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Is it okay just to get the chicken?
Yeah.
Is it okay to get both? No. So this is, in fact, okay, so this is the chicken or beef example. And let's look at what logical or looks like. So when we say chicken or beef in Boolean algebra, we mean it's not okay for them both to be false. It is okay for one or the other, and it is okay to be both. That's or in Boolean logic. This is or in chicken or beef. It's not the same thing. In fact, can anybody say what this is like? Let me write down what and looks like. So what's and? So when is and true? So chicken and beef. That's only true when? In the last case, when I get both chicken and beef. So it's false, 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 true. Okay? So chicken or beef, what is it in this case? It's exactly the opposite of and. It's not actually or, it's not and. This is very weird, right? Here they were false, true, false, true, false, true, false. So in English is what it is. English is a very useful, very powerful language. But it's not very precise. And the word or can mean lots of different things. But in Boolean algebra, this is what or means. It means it's true as long as one of the other cases is true. All right? You okay with that? There's a lot of other good examples, like your money or your life. They don't mean or. And you don't want to, like, mess with them. Even worse than the waiters. You don't want to mess with the guy with the gun. All right. I want to take a minute, and actually, there's kind of the grand unification equation that makes and, or, and not all in one place together. And it's called Gorman's Law. Which makes you want to go like this, but I think that's something else. What is that? It's not De Morgan. Is it Morgan? Captain Morgan. So, I think he was a logician. This is older than Morgan, that Morgan. Captain Morgan. So, here's what Morgan's Law says. It says, if you take the not of x and y, that's actually the same as taking the or of not x and not y. Similarly, we can switch that whole thing around and say that the negation of x or y is actually the same as the and of the negations of x and y. So they're all kind of related to each other. And what's neat about this is you knew this already. I don't know if you knew this already. But this is, people do this kind of reasoning all the time. I'm not sure this example didn't work last time I tried it. But let's, we could probably think of a better example if we just think of it. So, are you taking science and art? Right, so if I asked you that question, are you taking science and art, and then I looked at the eraser. Are you taking science and art? You can either say yes or no. Right? Or physics and art. It's either yes or no. If you say yes, then obviously you're taking both science and art, right? But what if you say no? What do we know at that point? That's true. So let's see, x and y. But we're saying it's not the case that I'm taking both science and art. So it must be the case that either I'm not taking science or I'm not taking art. Right? These things are the same. If I say I'm not doing both of them, then it must be that one or the other of them I'm not doing. That's what it means not to do both of them, right? Does that work? Because tell me this works, because otherwise I'm going to do this female crossword example, which is horrible. So this, I'm hoping this works better. Yeah.
Why can't we say, it's not x and it's not y? Why can't we say, what if you're a guy and you're not a crossword puzzle? Like, does that matter, or should we just make?
So let's stick with this example since it's sort of fresher in my head. So. It could be, I might ask you something like, are you taking science and are you taking art? I could ask you the two separate things, which you can answer in the test. But if I say, are you taking science and art? You're taking both of them. And if you're only allowed to say yes or no, you could, of course, elaborate. You could say, well, I'm taking science but not art, or no, actually, I'm taking neither. But if you say no, if all you say is no, what do I know at that point? All I know is that it's either the case that you're not doing science or you're not doing art, or both. Or, remember, or includes the both case.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So normal logical or, it's just one or the other or both. As long as one of them is true, it's fine. Right, so and really means all of these are true, or means at least one of these are true. That's another way to think about it. So that's, and that's why De Morgan's law works, right? That when we negate the and of something, we're actually negating all the individual pieces, but then you have to put them together with or, which is a little bit weird, but it is what you think. What if we had put and here? If I say, are you taking science and art, and you say no, does that mean you're taking neither of them? Not necessarily. You can still say no even if you're taking science but not art. Of course, it's not entirely conversationally helpful, right? I mean, this is when you interview little kids sometimes, you'll ask them complicated things like, oh, so do you enjoy weekends in the park and slushies? No. So tell me more. Like, we're trying to talk here. All right, so this is, pulling it out was all about not having a good conversation. All right, so another Morgan's Law example, moving on. All right, so what is there to say about this? So now clearly we can think about these kinds of logical operations. So our brains are powerful enough computing devices to be able to run these kind of Boolean algebra examples. Can we make a machine that can do the same thing? Well, it turns out, yes. But what we're going to do is we're going to start off with a really simple way of imagining what it means to put these kinds of these facts together. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to think in terms of electricity. And so one of the cool demos, I should be able to get to the cool demo before we're done. But actually, you know, make this come to life. All right, so here's a really simple circuit. And if you've taken electricity before, it's possible that I've actually not done this justice. But if you haven't, it's still pretty simple, and I think everyone's going to be able to follow this. So here's the basic idea. This is the symbol for a battery. So this is putting out electricities, electrons. This is the symbol for ground. It just means that it's... It just completes the circuit. So the battery comes out, there's a wire connected to a switch, which in this case is just a wire that can go up and down, and either make contact with the wire on the other side or break the contact with the wire on the other side. That wire then gets connected to a light bulb, which gets connected to ground to complete the circuit. So we've got the switch we can think of as being a Boolean variable, Boolean algebra variable. It's either true or false. And we're going to say true means the switch is in the closed position, meaning it connects the circuit, and false means it's in the off position, the open position. Okay? The light bulb, you can also think of as being a Boolean variable. It's either on or off, true or false. So here we have a little circuit. The little circuit says when A is true, then the light is on. So light on is true. When A is false, then light on is false. All right? So now we're doing very, very simple kind of Boolean operations, but just, you know, in terms of physical wires and light bulbs and electricity. So in fact, I think, yeah, so you can actually think of this as being kind of a little equation. The little equation is right there. It says light on equals A. Whether or not the light is on can be determined simply by whether or not the switch is on. The switch is on, the light is on. Switch is off, the light is off. So they're equal to each other. All right, so now what happens if we take two switches? We have a circuit with two switches now. We'll let the first one be A and the second one be B. And each of them independently can be true or false. All right, now we've got a light. So let's look at this top circuit. These switches, does anybody know the name for this? We have two switches that are wired in... I heard parallel, I heard series. One of those, which one?
The top.
Oh, sorry, the one on top.
Then the bottom of series.
Yeah, the top one's parallel, the bottom of series. So let's look at the parallel one first. Don't clutter your mind. Nothing here at the moment. All right, so the top one is, they're in parallel. And so... at the moment, the light bulb would be on, we would close the switch B, the light is on. If we have both of the switches open, or in the false position, if A and B are both false, then what happens to the light bulb?
Well,
it's false, right? We've broken the circuit. But if we close either of them, the light bulb goes on, right? So this is a logical, we can think of that as being a logical equation. Either will light the bulb. All right, and the second one, this one is in series. So how do we get, in this case, C, we have switch C is currently true, switch D is currently false, and the light is currently false. What do we need to do to get this light on? You have to make them both true. You have to close both switches. And then, you know, just thinking about this as electricity running across the wire, now it has a nice clean way to go all the way through to the light bulb. Now, me being not an electronics person, I think about like cars or dog. I don't know, just things kind of running along a sidewalk, and then there's a bridge, and the bridge is up, and they all go, right? And they can't make it across, and so the light bulb doesn't get lit. Because obviously light bulbs are lit by people running across. All right, so top of this parallel, bottom of the series. Oh, right. So what is the logical expression that the first one represents? The light is on when? If A or B is true, or both. Right, that's an or. That's what or is. What about the bottom one? Right, it's I and D. That's what I was about to say. It's C and D. The only way that the light is on is if C and D are both on. Okay, so now it's little switches and wires and stuff, but it's actually computing little Boolean functions for us. Now, it turns out with this kind of simple circuit, I don't know how to do not. I don't think it's possible to do not. It's hard to make a switch that when you close it, the light bulb goes off, but when you open it, it goes on. You do this. In houses, they do have stuff that actually does this, but they're fancier switches than the kind that I've gotten wrong. In fact, they can be these kind of switches. But let me show off a little bit. I was very excited about this. So I was saying that I was going to use scraps this semester for demos. So I have to the bomb. All right. So here we go. So I made a little battery thing. I made a little wire thing. I made a little switch thing, and I made a little light bulb thing. And whenever I click on the switch, it just changes from the up position to the down position. And it lights the light bulb. And if I click on it again, it unlights the light bulb. Now, I actually ended up putting a little delay in the program because it made the program simpler. But you can almost now see the electrons running down the road and going over the bridge, right? Well, watch, I close it. There's like this little delay before the light bulb actually lights. All right, so that's a really simple one. So now we can do the series of parallel as well. Alright, so here we've got our two switches wired in parallel. We can break one.
Series,
thank you.
Sure that you can't be series.
Alright, so now we close this switch and nothing happens. Why? Because the purple didn't make it to that switch yet. It's closed. Electricity should be able to flow over it, but there's no electricity getting to it. Well, then now we can make electricity get to it, but it still doesn't light because it's not closed. But now we close both of them. Ding. All right. And, I mean, I guess the PowerPoint slides or whatever actually more or less convey the same thing. So maybe this is really kind of only fun for me. But we will work up a little bit. I'll actually let you run these at home.
Why is it not for me?
All right, so here's our, what is this, how is this wired? I'll let you say it because I can make it wrong. All right, so we close this one, light goes on. Close this one, light goes on. Close them both, light goes on. This is why it's one or the other or both, but they're all the same as far as four is concerned. Okay, so then, let's stop this. Alright, so I want to introduce one more kind of component, and then I'll show you a fancy circuit, but I don't think I'll have a lot of time to talk about it. So, these are, anybody who knows more about like home electronics, not electronics even, it's just home electricity, So switch B is a new kind of switch I haven't drawn yet, that you open and close it, and they're kind of tethered together. Can't quite do it. They're tethered together, so when I close them, they both close, and when I open them, they both open. They're kind of tied together with that dotted line. I think this is called a double throw switch. Okay, so it's a switch that when you activate it, actually closes two circuits simultaneously. So A is one of them and B is one of them. So now here's the question. Look at the first light bulb, this light bulb that's right above me. That will light up under what conditions? What's the logical expression in terms of switches A and B?
Switch A
that would like this quote?
A or B.
So A or B? That seem right? I'm actually looking at it. So.
And is included in A or B.
And is, yeah, both, or includes the both case. And only includes the both case. So this is, we're calling this or,
yeah.
And what about the other guy? Is that also or? Maybe I should look. So. But this time it might actually be no. Oh, no, I didn't actually finish building it. Never mind. So really what we're seeing here is if we close the B switch, then that light bulb will go on. If we close the A switch, then this light bulb will go on. If we close both the switches, right, the only way that this light bulb goes on is if the electricity makes it through that middle path. So both A and B have to be in the on position for this bulb to light. But this one, either of them can be on. So this bulb is the and. This is A and B. And this one is A or B.
So the electricity can travel down both?
Through the little dash line?
No, not the dash line. You see where B can travel? You see that little, the solid line right there? That's on right
here? I can't reach it.
You got a mouse?
When B is closed, electricity flows down this wire, up, and then across, and into this light bulb.
But when A closes, can it flow down that same wire into the light bulb?
This wire is not connected to the light bulb.
But you have the top rods for A. The top one,
yeah.
A flows.
Electricity, if A is closed, electricity can flow to here, it can go down to here, it can go to here, and then it stops.
But no, I'm saying can it go down and over to the light bulb?
You mean over here?
Yeah.
So this is my bad drawing of what it means for two wires to cross each other without touching. That's like a bridge.
Oh, okay.
So that's not your fault, that's just my artistic lack of skill. Alright, so I want you to think about this a little bit. Well, we're going to play this game on Wednesday. But this is a game called Mini-Nim that I'm going to play against. Well, maybe I shouldn't let you think about it, because I want to beat you the first time. So never mind. So forget about this for a second, but let me show you the ultimate scratch circuit problem. There's battery, there's switches, but there's also double throw switches. And what this does is actually plays the game of NIM that we're going to talk about next time. In the book, Hillis talks about that he did something like this for the game of tic-tac-toe. But as far as I could tell, doing that would be enormous. There'd be like hundreds of components, and I didn't think any of us could kind of absorb that fast enough. But this is actually small enough that we could fit it on a slide and actually play with it. So I will demo this for us on Wednesday.